Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Numbers, chapter 23, verses 1 through 30, Balaam's first two oracles. Our context is this. In Numbers, chapter 22, we see Balaam on a donkey with two servants heading down south from Pethor, his home in Syria. And he's going down, probably down the king's highway there in the desert, headed down to Moab. Actually goes all the way down to Ar, south of the Arnon River, meets the king of Moab, Balak. Balak, of course, has tried to hire him. And all in chapter 22, we see how God has told Balaam first. He says, don't go down there. And then when Balaam asks him again, he says, all right, you can go down there, but you only prophesy what I tell you to prophesy. And the whole time, Balaam is trying to get God to let him go down there and curse Israel because he wants the money that Balak is going to pay him. And finally, God gets fed up with him, shows up as the angel of Jehovah, Jesus, in front of an alleyway there in a vineyard, makes the donkey lay down under Balaam, makes the donkey talk and mock Balaam and say bad things to him. And so Balaam has finally got through his head, maybe I better not mess with this guy. But he keeps on going down there for the ostensible purpose to curse Israel. Of course, the reason God wanted him to go down there was to bless Israel instead and make a great story that we can all remember even to this day. So here we are in Numbers 23, verses 1 and 2. Then Balaam said to Balak, build 7 altars for me here and prepare 7 bulls and 7 rams for me here. Balak did just as Balaam had spoken, and Balak and Balaam offered up a bull and a ram on each altar. Now you'll notice that the sacrifice has got similar flavorings as the Levitical sacrifice that Yahweh set up. You got 7 altars. 7 is, of course, the famous divine number of complete perfection that you see all the way through the Old Testament, especially the law. Then Avi Study Bible points out that this number was held in high regard among Semitic peoples in general, not just Israelites. And of course, we know that it signifies completeness and perfection, as the NIV Study Bible and Adam Clark say. Now, why so many? Why 7 altars with 7 bulls and 7 rams? Well, the NIV Study Bible says that many bulls and rams would provide many livers and organs to do divination with, as the pagans did. Gill, on the other hand, has a different take. He says that the purpose of the 7 bulls and the 7 rams, such a huge offering, was to win God over. Because Balaam is determined, maybe God will just let me curse these people and I'll make a lot of money. Gill and Clark say that some people say that Balaam was building an altar for each of the 7 planets. Now, of course, back in the 1800s when Gill and Clark wrote, there were 7 planets. When I grew up, there were 9 planets. Now, they've decided there are 8 planets. I don't think anybody in the universe knows how many planets there are out there. But Adam Clark says this is a trifling idea. The real reason is he wanted to sacrifice a lot of animals, so he needed a lot of altars, so he built 7 altars, not one for each planet. Now, where is the sacrifice going on? Build 7 altars for me here. Well, let's look at the context in the last chapter, the last 3 verses, Numbers 22, 39 through 41. So Balaam went with Balak and came to Kiriath Huzoth. Now, this is coming up from Ar, which is south of the Arnon River. Arnon River is about halfway south down the Dead Sea. All of this, of course, is taking place on the east of the Dead Sea. And then if you go north from Ar up to about even with the northern top of the Dead Sea, that's just about where the Israelites are. That's where Mount Pisgah is. Heshbon's around there. So they go up there, and Kiriath Huzoth is apparently around there somewhere. Nobody knows exactly where it is, but they're up there where they can see the Israelites camped. When they go up in the mountains, they look down, they can see some of them. And so that's where they are now. They're in the vicinity of that massive amount of Israelites camped at the staging area there. They're getting ready to cross the Jordan River to go into the Promised Land. And they've already offered to just bypass Moab and not give them trouble, but Moab doesn't believe that. Balak is convinced that the Israelites are going to do them harm, and so they're still in a military situation here. They can't just leave there and cross the Jordan River yet. They're scared the Moabites are going to attack them. And so before that happens, though, Balak's got to make sure that they're cursed so that he can win any kind of a military confrontation. Now, bulls and rams that's typical animals used in the Mosaic Law. A male ram was used in the guilt offering. The bulls and rams are used in peace offerings and whole burnt offerings. Typical animals prescribed by the Mosaic Law, which led some commentators to think Balaam was trying to win God over. Perhaps. I think he was. I think that's exactly what he was trying to do. The seven altars weren't legal according to Mosaic law, of course, because there was only one altar allowed. All of this reminds us of the verse in Proverbs 21, verse 27. The sacrifice of the wicked is an abomination. How much more when he brings it with evil intent? Now, in verse 2, Balak does just as Balaam had spoken, which shows that now Balaam is in charge. As the NIV Study Bible points out, Balaam is in charge, not Balak. We go to Numbers 23, verses 3 through 7. Then Balaam said to Balak, "Stand beside your burnt offering, and I will go. Perhaps the Lord will come to meet me, and whatever he shows me, I will tell you." So he went to a bare hill. Now God met Balaam, and he said to him, "I have set up," and Balaam said to Yahweh, "I have set up the seven altars, and I have offered up a bull and a ram on each altar. Look at me, I'm a good boy. I'm giving you a bunch of sacrifices, God, so how about do what I want?" Verse 5, "Then the Lord put a word in Balaam's mouth and said, 'Return to Balak, and you shall speak thus.' So he," that's Balaam, "returned to him," returned to Balak, "and behold, Balak was standing beside his burnt offering, he and all the leaders of Moab. He," that's Balaam, "took up his discourse and said," this is Balaam speaking now, "'From Aram, Balak has brought me.'" Aram is another word for Syria, up there in Pethor on the Euphrates River, right 10, 15 miles south of Carchemish. That's where Balaam had come from. And Balaam is speaking now to the leaders of Moab. "'From Aram, from Syria, Balak has brought me, Moab's king, from the mountains of the east. Come curse Jacob for me, and come denounce Israel.'" First of all, we note that in verse 3, Balaam says, "Perhaps the Lord will come to meet me." As he's talking to Balak, he says, "Maybe, Balak, maybe the Lord Yahweh will come to meet me." Balaam wasn't sure that God would come to meet him, and I understand why. God had already expressed great displeasure with him, as the incident with the talking ass showed. The angel of the Lord actually said he would have killed Balaam if the ass hadn't stopped him. That ass saved Balaam's life, actually, and the angel of Jehovah, whom I assume was Jesus, was extremely upset with Balaam. So sure, Balaam's not sure. And God told him, "You go down there and you don't do anything but what I tell you." And so, you know, Balaam is not going to go up there and do what Balak says, even though he wants Balak's money, because I'm sure he's afraid of God now. Now, maybe Balaam was unsure that God would listen to him, that Yahweh would listen to him, because God had before come to him only in the nighttime, and this was in the daytime. That's an interesting idea. I don't really know how much stock I put into that. Gill deduces that it was in the nighttime, I think, by looking at Numbers 22:41, where it says Balaam was on the mountain there and he saw the outskirts of the people's camp. We'll see that in just a minute. Well, you're not going to see the outskirts of the people's camp except in the daytime. Most probably, maybe you could see the campfires. I don't think so. So it's probably daytime. Now, verse 4 says God met Balaam. So God said, "Okay, you want to talk to me, Balaam? I'll talk to you." And then God put a word in Balaam's mouth. This is what God said. "You're supposed to go back to Balak and say this, and you're going to say exactly like I told you to say." Now, when it says that God met Balaam, according to John Gill, God did not meet Balaam in a kind and gracious manner. He did not meet Balaam out of respect for the offerings that Balaam and Balak had offered. He did not meet Balaam to indulge in spiritual communion with him. He did not meet Balaam to communicate his mind and will to him as a friend. He did not meet Balaam, Yahweh didn't. He didn't meet Balaam to gratify Balaam's desire to make money by denouncing Israel. Oh no! He met Balaam in order to make Balaam bless his people Israel and make a great story, a great object lesson. So God puts into Balaam's mouth a discourse. Now, Adam Clark says that the oracles that God put in Balaam's mouth, and we're going to see there's four of them. This is just the first two in this chapter. The oracles were poetic and highly dignified, as Adam Clark says, and in the style of a prophet, as Jamin Fawcett and Brown says. And that's not surprising, is it not? It was God who put the oracle in Balaam's mouth. We'll see in our next chapter, I think it's right before the third oracle. There's four altogether. Balaam lifted, in Numbers 24:2, Balaam lifted up his eyes and saw Israel camping tribe by tribe, and the Spirit of God came upon him. So we got the Holy Spirit now is telling Balaam what to say. Quite interesting, is it not? A demonic soothsayer being used by the Holy Spirit of God. Who's in charge, the demons or the Holy Spirit? Now, this discourse that God put in Balaam's mouth, it's translated discourse here in the NASB and also in the ESV. The NIV has oracle. The Holman Christian Study Bible has message. The King James has parable. So the English translations are all over the place. They generally mean the same thing. The NIV Study Bible has an interesting comment. The study Bible says that the Hebrew word that's translated that variously that way is mashal, and that word is usually used to describe a proverb, but God put a proverb in his mouth doesn't quite work. The NIV study Bible says oracle is a good translation. However, none of Israel's true prophecies are described by mashal, as the NIV study Bible also notes, thus indicating that Balaam was not a true prophet of God. In other words, God using a different word than prophecy or oracle, but using a word that is used, not normally used of true prophecies by God's prophets. This shows that this is not on the same level as, say, Isaiah or Jeremiah. Now, one little minor point here at verse 7, a little translation problem, I think. He took up his discourse, that's Balaam, and said, he's talking now to the leaders of Moab, and he says, from Aram, Balak has brought me Moab's king from the mountains of the east. Well, to whom does the mountains of the east refer to? So let me read you Numbers 23, verse 7 in the King James. And he took up his parable and said, Balak, the king of Moab, hath brought me from Aram out of the mountains of the east. Balak, the king of Moab, hath brought me from Aram out of the mountains of the east, saying, come curse me, Jacob. So Balak, the king of Moab, has brought me out of the mountains of the east. So it sounds like it's Balaam coming out of the mountains of the east. And almost all the commentators I looked at says it's Balaam. Even though the NASB sounds like it's Moab's king that comes from the mountains of the east. Let me read the NASB again. From Aram, Balak has brought me Moab's king from the mountains of the east. Well, it just depends on where you place that phrase, from the mountains of the east. Well, I think it's talking about the mountains of the east, referring to the mountains of Mesopotamia that form the Mesopotamian Valley, and so therefore it's referring to Balaam came from the mountains of the east because he was in Syria, right? He was in Mesopotamia, basically, up there from Pethor. Colin Dillett says this, Balak, the king of Moab, fetches me from Aram from the mountains of the east, i.e. of Mesopotamia, which was described as far back as Genesis 29:1 as the land of the sons of the east. Balaam mentions the mountains of his home in contradistinction to the mountains of the land of the Moabites upon which he was then standing. So east generally refers to Mesopotamian Valley when you're talking about the ancient Near East in Israel. So we're going to take it that way, despite the way the NIV and the NASB translate it, which makes it sound like it's referring to Balak. Now, if it does refer to Balak, mountains of the east, I guess, would be mountains to the east of the Jordan, referring to the Moabite mountains. Again, a extremely minor point, but since I'm doing these audios in the interest of thoroughness, I thought I would mention it. Now, let's go to Numbers 23, verses 8 through 10. This is Balaam still talking to the elders of Moab. How shall I curse whom God has not cursed? And how can I denounce whom the Lord has not denounced? As I see him from the top of the rocks, and I look at him from the hills, behold, a people who dwells apart, and will not be reckoned among the nations. Who can count the dust of Jacob, or number the fourth part of Israel? Let me die the death of the upright, and let my end be like his. Then Balak said to Balaam, what have you done to me? I took you to curse my enemies, but behold, you have actually blessed them. He, that's Balaam, replied, must I not be careful to speak what the Lord puts in my mouth? So Balaam is not going along with Balak, and he's not cursing Israel. Now, he's not blessing them yet, but he's not cursing them. He's sort of neutral. Balaam's fear of God is now overcoming his love of Balak's money. And that's why the angel of Jehovah made Balaam's ass talk to him, make fun of him, scare him. Now, in verse 9, Balaam says, as I look at him, talking about Yahweh, talking what he doesn't call him Yahweh, he calls him God. As I look at God from the hills, how does he look at God? Well, I imagine he's looking at all the people of Israel down there and looking at all the nature that God made. I'm not exactly sure what he means, but he realizes that something's going on here. God has arranged all these Israelites to be down there. And I look at them and I see a people who dwells apart. That means physically and geographically apart. They're not a part of anybody theirs. They're on their sojourn, their exodus from Egypt. They're ethnically apart, their languages, their laws, their customs, their clothing, their food. That's a nation that people that dwell apart. They're ethically, spiritually, and religiously apart. They're monotheist and not pagan polytheist. Or it could be all of the above, but yeah, the Israelites were a peculiar people, and this is what Balaam is saying. They dwell apart from everybody else. They are not reckoned among the nations. In other words, there's nations and nations and nations, and then there's Israel. They're different. And Adam Clark makes the point that even to this day, well, his day was the 1800s, we're now in 2100s, The Jews are still distinct, even after over three millennia. Yes, they are. We tend to know who Jews are culturally. They hold on to their culture, even though they've abandoned their belief in God for the most part. But they've still held on to their culture, and they have their own land in Israel. So, yeah, they're a nation apart. And so Balaam refers back, now I don't know if he knew the Abrahamic prophecies, but when he says, who can count the dust of Jacob? That sounds an awful lot like Genesis 28:14. Your descendants will also be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. And in you and in your descendants shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Now that's the B and the L-O-B blessings, land, offspring, and blessings that God promises all through Genesis to Abraham. Refers to and that promise in verse 14 of Genesis 28 is, your descendants will also be like the dust of the earth. Well, you can't count the grains of sand and the dust. And that's what Balaam says in verse 10, who can count the dust of Jacob? Or number the fourth part of Israel. Not only can you not count all of them, you can't even divide them up into fours and count one fourth of them. There's so much. And then he says, let me die the death of the upright and let my end be like his. In other words, let me be upright and not curse Israel. He doesn't say bless Israel, but he says at least not, I'm not going to curse them. Now, the ironic thing is Balaam did not die the death of the upright. His request was not granted. Numbers 31:8 says this, they, that's the Israelites, killed the kings of Midian. The Midianites were allied with the Moabites. The Israelites killed the kings of Midian along with the rest of their slain, Ephi and Rechem and Zur and Hur and Reba, the five kings of Midian. They also killed Balaam, the son of Beor. That's our Balaam here. Killed him with the sword, so he got killed in the upcoming battles with the enemies of God's people. All right, so Balak's upset. He doesn't get the cursing he wants. So we go now to Numbers 23, verses 13 and 14. Then Balak said to Balaam, please come with me to another place from where you may see them, although you will only see the extreme end of them, and you will not see all of them, and curse them for me from there. So he, that's Balak, took Balaam to the field of Zophim to the top of Pisgah. That's the famous Mount Pisgah where Moses died. To the top of Pisgah and built seven altars and offered a bull and ram on each altar. They're still building the altars. Seven more altars. Now, Balak says, Balaam, you're not going to see all of the Israelites. Now, why? The NIV Study Bible and John Gill says that Balak is trying to reduce Israel's power by letting Balaam see just a part of them. I guess the idea is, well, you'll be overwhelmed, Balaam, if you try to curse all these Israelites. We'll just let you curse a fourth, and we'll do it in installments. But unfortunately for Balak, as the NIV Study Bible points out, the second oracle's blessings exceeded the first. Remember, the first oracle was, I'm not going to curse them, and now we're going to see the second oracle in just a minute, and we're going to see that this is even a better oracle for Israel than the first one. So poor old Balak is coming up short in his efforts to co-opt Balaam into his service of cursing Israel. Now, as John Gill points out, it could be the idea that Balaam has is, if I can just get him to curse a fourth of them, or a part of them, not a fourth, but a part of them, if I can do that, then he'll get used to it and he'll go ahead and curse the rest of them. He'll do it in piecemeal. Adam Clark says this, quote, he, that's Balak, might get Balaam to curse them in detached parties till the whole camp should be devoted to destruction by successive execrations. We go now, and notice again, seven more altars. That seven is that divine holy number in the ancient Near East, not just in Israel, as the NIV Study Bible pointed out, and I mentioned in the last audio. We go now to Numbers 23, verses 15 through 20. And he, that's Balaam, said to Balak, stand here beside your burnt offering while I myself meet the Lord over there. Then the Lord met Balaam and put a word in his mouth and said, return to Balak, and thus you shall speak. He came to him, and behold, Balak was standing beside his burnt offering, and the leaders of Moab with him. And Balak said to him, what has the Lord spoken? Then he took up his discourse and said, you notice everything is parallel. That's the ancient literature likes to do all these things, repetition and parallel. So everything's the same, except it's the second discourse now. So verse 18, then he, that's Balaam, took up his discourse and said, arise, O Balak, and hear. Give ear to me, O son of Zippor. Sort of formal language. God is not a man that he should lie, nor a son of man that he should repent. Has he said, and will he not do it? Or has he spoken, and will he not make it good? Behold, I have received a command to bless. When he is blessed, then I cannot revoke it. Ooh, bad news for Balak. He says, not only am I going to refrain from cursing him, I've been commanded to bless those people. and God doesn't change his mind. Well, by now, Balak knows that Balaam is totally under the influence of Yahweh, but he still figured, well, maybe I can get Balak to change his mind. That's why he moved into a different spot, tried to get him to do it again. Of course, the results were even worse. Now, in verse 18, when Balaam says to Balak, arise in here. Well, Balak was already standing by. It says he was standing by his burnt offering, so why would he say arise if he's already standing? Well, the expression is equivalent to now attend to me. Now attend to me. Listen to me. As Jameson Fawcett Brown says, we don't want to take that too literally because it was not meant to be. Now, in verse 19, Balaam says God is not a man that he should lie. Well, Balaam is a prime example of a man who lies. Here's what the NIV Study Bible says about Balaam. He was, quote, constantly shifting, prevaricating, equivocating, changing. They should have said tergiversating. That's another word they could have used. They didn't. A prime example of the distinction between God and man. Well, why is God telling Balaam to tell Balak that God is a God who will not lie? In order to correct Balak's foolish notion that God might change his mind. Because Balak still, you know, he's trying to offer sacrifices. Come on, God, change your mind. Curse these people. Basically, Balak was treating Yahweh like a typical pagan deity who were pathetic. It's so superstitious, you know, you rub the idol's belly this way and get him to do what he want. Get him to do what you want. Give him a pig or something. Get him to do what you want. It, you know, it's just sickening. But Yahweh's not the same. He's not going to change his mind. Adam Clark says that it was absurd for Balak to do that because even heathen wouldn't allow their supreme God to be caught in a falsity. In other words, even the pagan gods don't lie. But I must say against Clark here a little bit is that changing God's mind and getting him to change his mind is not exactly the same thing as uttering a lie. I mean, Moses did that a lot of times when he said, God, don't destroy the Israelites. Please change your mind, God. And God changed his mind. Speaking anthropomorphically, he changed his mind. He repented from what he was going to do. Well, that might be true that God might do that every now and then, but he's not going to do it for Balaam. This is it, boy. I'm not changing my mind. I told Abraham that I was going to bless his people. I'm going to bless them. I'm going to make their offspring like the dust of the seashore and the stars of the sky. I'm not going to revoke my blessing, my covenant promise. Numbers chapter 23, verses 21 and 22. God has not observed misfortune in Jacob, nor has he seen trouble in Israel. The Lord his God is with him. Israel's God is with him. And the shadow of a king is among them. God brings them out of Egypt. He is for them like the horns of a wild ox. Now, first of all, verse 21, God has not observed misfortune in Jacob. That means that God is looking down and he's not going to see Jacob cursed, to have misfortune, to come to grief, not to make it to the promised land. That's what the prophecy means, the oracle means. But this cannot be taken literally. He has not observed misfortune in Jacob because Israel had plenty of misfortune, most of it brought upon themselves. Korah's rebellion, remember that? The fields of Taberah, when the burning happened. And another judgment, the scorpions that came upon them around the head of the Gulf of Aqaba. Oh, lots of bad things. So it's not meant to be taken literally. It means, hey, there's not going to be any misfortune in Jacob because God's going to bless them and get them into Israel. Now, the King James has here for misfortune, iniquity. The King James translated the Hebrew verb, as iniquity. So it would read this way. He has not observed iniquity in Jacob. Well, that's another problem because there's been plenty of iniquity in Israel and Jacob. Plenty. Here's what Adam Clark says about this word that's translated differently, either as misfortune in the modern translations or as iniquity in the King James. Quote, this is a difficult passage, for if we take the words as spoken of the people Israel, as their iniquity and their perverseness were almost unparalleled, such words cannot be spoken of them with strict truth. Yeah, same thing with misfortune. God saw misfortune in Israel, same thing with iniquity. God saw that. So what are we talking about here? Well, here's what Adam Clark says. There is another way in which the words he's talking about two words, iniquity and trouble, but let's just take the first one, iniquity or misfortune. There is another way in which the word may be interpreted, which will give a good sense. The Hebrew word is aven, A-V-E-N, I hope I pronounced that right. Not only signifies iniquity, but most frequently trouble, labor, distress, and affliction. In other words, misfortune, as the modern translation have it. And these indeed are its ideal meanings. This Hebrew word aven has an ideal meaning, a primary meaning of trouble, labor, distress. Iniquity, as a translation, is only an accommodated or metaphorical translation because of the pain and distress produced by sin. So, I think we have good warrant to take the translation as God has not observed misfortune in Jacob, because God is going to get the people to the promised land. Now Israel is said to have a king in verse 21. And the shout of a king is among them, Balaam says. Well, who's the king of Israel? That would be God. The NIV Study Bible says this is the first explicit declaration of the Lord's kingship in the Pentateuch. The last thing that Balaam says here is says that God is for them, for the Israelites, like the horns of the wild ox. Well, an ox is the traditional image of power in the Near East, and that's not surprising. Those animals are very, very strong. They pull plows and such. The NIV Study Bible says the original word can be translated as aurochs, A-U-R-O-C-H-C-H-S, an animal I've never heard of, or an oryx, O-R-Y-X, never heard of that one either. Animals don't translate well from language to language. We go now to Numbers 23, verses 23 through 26. For there is no omen against Jacob, Balaam continues, talking to Balak and the elders of Moab. There is no omen against Jacob. Jacob, of course, is how Israel is referred to metaphorically. For there is no omen against Jacob, nor is there any divination against Israel. At the proper time it shall be said to Jacob and to Israel what God has done. Behold, a people rises like a lioness, and as a lion it lifts itself. It will not lie down until it devours the prey and drinks the blood of the slain. Then Balak said to Balaam, do not curse them at all or bless them at all. He's headed with Balaam. Just stop it. But Balaam replied to Balak, did I not tell you whatever the Lord speaks that I must do? Now, Balaam in verse 23 says, for there is no omen against Jacob. Well, Balaam has had frightful experience of that. The angel of the Lord had stopped him already from cursing Israel. I guess that's referring to the talking donkey incident. And God has said himself, however he appeared to Balaam, stop it. Don't you do it. And so Balaam says, yeah, that's not going to be any cursing against Jacob. And he says, nor is there any divination. That's, of course, pagan, demonic ways of cursing Israel. He's not going to do it. And he says, at the proper time, it shall be said to Jacob and to Israel, of course, that's the same thing to the people of Israel. It shall be said, what God has done. In other words, wow, isn't it great how he's delivered us? Now, what's the proper time that this will be said? I assume it's the time at which, after the deliverance. John Gill takes that a little further, and he says the proper time means this, quote, with respect to this time as well as to time past and with respect to time to come, even with respect to all times, it shall be said with wonder and amazement, what great things has God done for this people, as bringing them out of the land of Egypt, leading them through the Red Sea, feeding and supplying them in the wilderness, protecting them from their enemies there, expelling the inhabitants of the land of Canaan, and setting them there in their stead. Well, that's what happened. And we're still talking about Cecil B. DeMille made a movie called The Ten Commandments, basically along that theme. Wow, what an amazing thing that God delivered the people from slavery in Egypt. And, of course, this rise of Israel is poetically described as a lion lifting itself up, devouring its prey. Now, the proper time that all this praise in Israel of God's deliverance is not translated proper time in the KJV is this time. Let me read that. Numbers 23:23. Surely there is no enchantment against Israel, neither is there any divination against Israel. According to this time it shall be said of Jacob and of Israel, what hath God wrought? Well, that would narrow it down to the time of God's deliverance from Moab. People will say what God has done. And frankly, I think that's what it's talking about. I think Gil's talking about all the praises of Yahweh because of the general exodus and deliverance to Israel. That's a little bit too broad. I think that what Balaam's talking about here is people are going to be praising about how God delivered the Israelites from the Moabites. Balak, put that in your pipe and smoke it. So Balak's pretty upset by now, because he's obviously, this is the second time that Balaam has bucked him. And now the second oracle, the first oracle was Balaam says, I'm not going to curse Israel. The second article is, man, Israel's victories are going to be so great that people are going to be shouting praise about it. So it's getting worse for poor old Balak. And so Balak says, don't curse them. Don't bless them. Just forget about it. Well, a question might arise. Why would Balak say, don't curse Israel, since he had gone to such lengths to get Israel cursed? Well, I'm paraphrasing John Gill here. Basically, Balak is saying, if you're not going to do what I wanted, Balaam, then keep your mouth shut. Ray the blessing. In other words, it's obviously you're not going to curse them, so let's forget the blessing too. Shut up. You've said enough. Forget about it. I'm off. The deal's off. Balaam calmly replies to Balak, did I not tell you, Balak, whatever the Lord speaks, that I must do? I'm telling you that Israel is going to devour its prey, just as Israel is about to start to devouring the Canaanites. As the NIV Study Bible says, one after another, they beat them in combat. And the Moabites are going to be involved in that disaster from Balak's point of view as Israel successfully invades the land of Israel. They, of course, they take care of the Moabites and the Midianites on the way in, which we'll read about in a few chapters. Israel is said to poetically drink the blood of the slain. Of course, they don't literally drink the blood of the slain, but that's a great metaphor, isn't it? Lions literally drink the blood of their slain, and so that horrible image is applied to Israel on the march. This may particularly refer to the slaughter of the Midianites that was shortly coming. We read in Numbers 31:7, so they made war against Midian, just as the Lord had commanded that Moses, and they killed every male. And ironically, Balaam, as I quoted to you earlier in Numbers 31:8, Balaam was killed also as the lion of Israel devoured their prey and drank the blood of their enemies. We go now to Numbers 23, verses 27 through 30, and we'll finish up this audio and this chapter. Then Balak said to Balaam, please come, I will take you to another place. Perhaps it will be agreeable with God that you curse them for me from there. Well, Balak's not going to give up, is he? So Balak took Balaam to the top of Peor, which overlooks the wasteland. Balaam said to Balak, build 7 altars for me here and prepare 7 bulls and 7 rams for me here. You notice everything's exactly the same. They just moved the place. Balak did just as Balaam had said and offered up a bull and a ram on each altar. So they went to another place. Why? Well, it could be because Balak was just superstitious. He says, well, maybe this Yahweh that Balaam's talking to just needs to be appealed to from a different place, which is pretty stupid, but, you know, paganism is pretty stupid, so he could have thought that. Could have been, this is my idea, that Israel might look smaller from a different place. They're not being able to see all of the 2 million Israelites from one vantage point, but maybe they could go to another vantage point and just see a smaller portion of Israel, and maybe that might give Balaam some more courage to carry out his cursing. Now notice in verse 27, Balak says, perhaps it will be agreeable with God that you curse them for me. Well, now it's clear that Balak no longer blames Balaam for not cursing Israel. Now he's starting to realize that God's in control of Balaam here, and so he's saying, okay, we need to change God's mind. John Gill says that Balak seems to concede that it was God, not Balaam, who did not want to curse Israel. In other words, Balaam's acting under constraint. So Balak took Balaam to the top of Peor. Now again, that's right there in that area right north of the Dead Sea, right to the east of the Jordan River, right across from Jerusalem, right across the Jordan from the Jerusalem. It's called a wasteland. KJV has Jeshimon, which might be a proper name, but we'll just call it wasteland. And as Jeshimon was considered, the wasteland was a desert tract in the south of Palestine on the west side of the Dead Sea as well as on the east side of the Dead Sea. So the wasteland was on both sides of the Jordan River at the northern tip of the Dead Sea, where the Jordan goes into the Dead Sea. So that's where Mount Peor is. This is not Mount Pisgah. And by the way, people debate Mount Pisgah. Some people say it's also the same mountain as the Mount Nebo. Sometimes it could be 2 different mountains in a similar mountain ridge. And so that's how names get confused. It doesn't matter. But this is a different one. This is Peor. This is where Balaam's going to look again. Build 7 more altars. We'll do it again. Balaam went along with this third attempt because he wants the money, as John Gill says. So this is the third time he's built 7 altars. Balaam didn't flinch at the high cost. Balak didn't flinch at the high cost, as John Gill says, even though at this point Balak should have had little hope of success after failing twice. Balak was rock solid in his conviction that the Israelites were going to destroy him. That's why he was so desperate. If he'd have just listened to Moses, Moses was willing to go around them and not hurt them at all. But since he was so afraid of all those people, that would perhaps explain his willingness to continue in his folly. Let's try it again, Balaam. If you first don't succeed, let's try again. Now, Mount Peor, where the third oracle is going to take place and the third sacrifice to Yahweh is going to take place, is the name of a high mountain in Moab. It's called Peor because of a gap or opening in the mountain. In other words, Peor must mean gap. There was an idol there that was worshipped that was called Baal Peor. We read that in Numbers 25:3. So Israel joined themselves to Baal of Peor, and the Lord was angry against Israel. Now, Adam Clark says that this place, Peor, is probably the place where the famous Baal Peor had his chief temple, that famous pagan deity. Ladies and gentlemen, we are now finished with Numbers chapter 23, Balaam's first two oracles. We'll take a look at his last two oracles in the next chapter, Numbers 24. I will do the entire chapter, and I hope to have you back with me then, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.